Chapter 14. Disc Worlds. To the Wizards of Unseen University, the heavens include two obviously different types of body: stars, which are tiny pinpricks of light, and the sun, which is a hot ball not too far away, which passes over the disc during the day and under it at night. It's taken humanity a while to realize that in our universe, it's not like that. Our sun is a star, and like all stars, it's huge, so those tiny pinpricks must be a very long way off. Moreover, some of the pinpricks that seem to be stars aren't. They betray themselves by moving differently from the rest. These are the planets, which are a lot closer and a lot smaller, and together with the Earth, Moon, and Sun, they form the solar system. Our solar system may look like a lot of balls whizzing around in some kind of cosmic game of pool, but that doesn't mean that it started out as balls or rock and ice. It is the outcome of a physical process, and the ingredients that went into that process are not obliged to resemble the result that comes out. The more we learn about the solar system, the more difficult it is to give a plausible answer to the question, how did it start? It is not the answer part that gets harder, it's the plausibility. As we learn more and more about the solar system, the reality check that our theories have to pass becomes more and more stringent. This is one reason why scientists have a habit of opening up old questions that everybody assumed were settled long ago and deciding that they weren't. It doesn't mean that scientists are incompetent. It demonstrates their willingness to contemplate new evidence and re-examine old conclusions in its light. Science certainly does not claim to get things right, but it has a good record of ruling out ways to get things wrong. What must a theory of the formation of the solar system explain? Principally, of course, the planets, 9 of them, dotted rather randomly in space. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto. It must explain their differences in size. Mercury is a mere 3,032 miles, 4,878 kilometers, in diameter, whereas Jupiter is 88,750 miles, 142,800 kilometers in diameter, 29 times as big, 24,000 times the volume, an enormous discrepancy. It must explain their differences in chemical composition. Mercury is made of iron, nickel, and silicate rock. Jupiter is made from hydrogen and helium. It must explain why the planets near the Sun are generally smaller than those further out, with the exception of tiny Pluto out in the cold and the dark. We don't know a great deal about Pluto, but most of what we do know is strange. For instance, all the other planets lie pretty close to a single plane through the center of the Sun, but Pluto's orbit is inclined at a noticeable angle. All the other planets have orbits that are pretty close to circles, but Pluto's orbit is much more elongated, to the extent that some of the time it is closer to the Sun than Neptune is. But that's not all that a theory of the origin of the solar system has to get right. Most planets have smaller bodies in orbit around them. Our own familiar Moon, Phobos and Deimos, the diminutive twin satellites of Mars, Jupiter's 16 satellites, Saturn's 17. Even Pluto has a satellite called Charon, and that's weird too. Saturn goes one better, and also has entire rings of smaller bodies surrounding it. A broad, thin band of encircling rocks that breaks up into a myriad distinct ringlets, with satellites mixed up among them, as well as more conventional satellites elsewhere. Then there are the asteroids, thousands of small bodies, some spherical like planets, others irregular lumps of rock, most of which orbit between Mars and Jupiter, except for quite a few that don't. There are comets, which fall in towards the Sun from the huge Oort cloud, way out beyond the orbit of Pluto, a cloud that contains trillions of comets. There is the Kuiper Belt, a bit like the asteroid belt, but outside Pluto's orbit. We know over 30 bodies out there now, but we suspect there are hundreds of thousands. These bodies are known as Kuiper Belt objects, or KBOs. A few years back, there was a big fuss because some astronomers wanted to redefine Pluto as a KBO rather than a planet. Pluto probably wouldn't have minded either way, but an awful lot of textbook publishers would have. The scientific case was strong. Pluto is weird in almost every respect, as we've just seen, and it could easily be a KBO that accidentally strayed into the outer reaches of the solar system when disturbed by other bodies. If so, that would explain why it's so weird. It doesn't look like a planet, because it isn't one. Other astronomers disagreed strongly with this proposal. For sentimental reasons, for historical reasons, or because we don't know for sure that Pluto is a wandering KBO. In the end, Pluto remained on the list of planets, but whether it can hang on to that status for much longer is unclear. Then, there are meteorites, lumps of rock of various sizes that wander erratically through the whole thing. Each of these celestial objects, moreover, is a one-off. Mercury is a blisteringly hot lump of cratered rock. Venus has a sulfuric acid atmosphere, rotates the wrong way compared to nearly everything else in the solar system, and is believed to resurface itself every 100 million years or so in a vast planet-wide surge of volcanic activity. Earth has oceans and supports life. Since we live on it, we find it the most congenial of the planets, but many aliens would probably be aghast at its deadly, poisonous, corrosive oxygen atmosphere. Mars has rock-strewn deserts and dry ice at its poles. Jupiter is a gas giant with a core of hydrogen compressed so much that it has become metallic, and maybe a small rocky core inside that. Small compared to Jupiter, but about 3 times the diameter of the Earth. Saturn has its rings, but so do Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune, though these are nowhere near as extensive or spectacular. Uranus has an icy mantle of methane and ammonia, and its axis of rotation is tilted so far that it is slightly upside down. Neptune is similar to Uranus, but without that ridiculous axial tilt. Pluto, as we've said, is just crazy. We don't even know accurately how big it is, or how massive it is, but it's a Lilliputian in the country of the gas giants. Right. All that is what a theory of the origins of the solar system has to explain. It was all a lot easier when we thought there were 6 planets, plus the Sun and the Moon, and that was it. As for the solar system being an act of special creation by a supernatural being, why would any self-respecting supernatural being make the thing so complicated? Because it makes itself complicated, that's why. We now think that the solar system was formed as a complete package, starting from quite complicated ingredients. But it took us a while to realize this. The first theory of planetary formation that makes any kind of sense, by modern standards, was thought up by the great German philosopher Immanuel Kant about 250 years ago. Kant envisaged it all starting as a vast cloud of matter, big lumps, small lumps, dust, gas, which attracted each other gravitationally and clumped together. About 40 years later, the French mathematician Pierre-Simon de Laplace came up with an alternative theory of enormous intrinsic beauty, whose sole flaw is that it doesn't actually work. Laplace thought that the Sun formed before the planets did, perhaps by some cosmic aggregation process like Kant's. However, that ancient Sun was much bigger than today's, because it hadn't fully collected together, and the outer fringes of its atmosphere extended well beyond what is now the orbit of Pluto. Like the Wizards of Unseen University, Laplace thought of the Sun as a gigantic fire, whose fuel must be slowly burning away. As the Sun aged, it would cool down. Cool gas contracts, so the Sun would shrink. Now comes a neat peculiarity of moving bodies, a consequence of another of Newton's laws, the law or laws of motion. Associated with any spinning body is a quantity called angular momentum, a combination of how much mass it contains, how fast it is spinning, and how far out from the center the spinning takes place. According to Newton, angular momentum is conserved. It can be redistributed, but it neither goes away nor appears of its own accord. If a spinning body contracts, but the rate of spin doesn't change, angular momentum will be lost, Therefore, the rate of spin must increase to compensate. This is how ice skaters do rapid spins. They start with a slow spin, arms extended, and then bring their arms in close to their body. Moreover, spinning matter experiences a force, centrifugal force, which seems to pull it outwards, away from its centre. Laplace wondered whether centrifugal force acting on a spinning gas cloud might throw off a belt of gas round the equator. He calculated that this ought to happen whenever the gravitational force attracting that belt towards the centre was equal to the centrifugal force trying to fling it away. This process would happen not once, but several times, as the gas continued to contract. So the shrinking sun would surround itself with a series of rings of material, all lying in the same plane as the sun's equator. Now, suppose that each belt coalesced into a single body. Planets. What Laplace's theory got right, but Kant's did not, was that the planets lie roughly in a plane, and they all rotate round the sun in the same direction that the sun spins. As a bonus, something rather similar might have occurred while those belts were coalescing into planets, in which case the motion of satellites is explained as well. It's not hard to combine the best features of Kant's and Laplace's theories, and this combination satisfied scientists for about a century. However, it slowly became clear that our solar system is far more unruly than either Kant or Laplace had recognized. Asteroids have wild orbits, and some satellites revolve the wrong way. The Sun contains 99% of the solar system's mass, but the planets possess 99% of its angular momentum. Either the Sun is rotating too slowly, or the planets are revolving too quickly. As the 20th century opened, these deficiencies of the Laplacian theory became too great for astronomers to bear, and several people independently came up with the idea that a star developed a solar system when it made a close encounter with another star. As the two stars whizzed past each other, the gravitational attraction from one of them was supposed to draw out a long cigar-shaped blob of matter from the other, which then condensed into planets. The advantage of the cigar shape was that it was thin at the ends and thick at the middle, just as the planets are small close to the Sun or out by Pluto, but big in the middle where Jupiter and Saturn live. Mind you, it was never entirely clear why the blob had to be cigar-shaped. One important feature of this theory was the implication that solar systems are rather uncommon because stars are quite thinly scattered and seldom get close enough together to share a mutual cigar. If you were the sort of person who'd been comforted by the idea that human beings are unique in the universe, then this was a rather appealing suggestion. If planets were rare, then inhabited planets would be rarer still. If you were the sort of person who preferred to think that the Earth isn't especially unusual, and neither are its life forms, then the cigar theory definitely put a crimp on the imagination. By the middle of the 20th century, the shared cigar theory had turned out to be even less likely than the Kant-Laplace theory. If you rip a lot of hot gas from the atmosphere of a star, it doesn't condense into planets. It disperses into the unfathomable depths of interstellar space, like a drop of ink in a raging ocean. But by then, astronomers were getting a much clearer idea of how stars originated, and it was becoming clear that planets must be created by the same processes that produced the stars. A solar system is not a sun that later acquires some tiny companions. It all comes as one package, right from the start. That package is a disk, the nearest thing in our universe, as far as we know, to Discworld. But the disk begins as a cloud and eventually turns into a lot of balls. Stibbon's third rule. Before the disk formed, the solar system and the sun started out as a random portion of a cloud of interstellar gas and dust. Random jigglings triggered a collapse of the dust cloud, with everything heading for roughly, but not exactly, the same central point. All it takes to start such a collapse is a concentration of matter somewhere, whose gravity then pulls more matter towards it. Random jigglings will produce such a concentration if you wait long enough. Once the process is started, it is surprisingly rapid, taking about 10 million years from start to finish. At first, the collapsing cloud is roughly spherical. However, it is being carried along by the rotation of the entire galaxy, so its outer edge, relative to the center of the galaxy, moves more slowly than its inner edge. Conservation of angular momentum tells us that as the cloud collapses, it must start spinning, and the more it collapses, the faster it spins. As its rate of spin increases, the cloud flattens out into a rough disk. More careful calculations show that near the middle, this disk thickens out into a dense blob, and most of the matter ends up in the blob. The blob condenses further, its gravitational energy gets traded for heat energy, and its temperature goes up fast. When the temperature rises enough, nuclear reactions are ignited. The blob has become a star. While this is happening, the material in the disk undergoes random collisions, just as Kant imagined, and coalesces in a not terribly ordered way. Some clumps get shoved into wildly eccentric orbits or swung out of the plane of the disk. Most clumps, however, are better behaved and turn into decent, sensible planets. A miniature version of the selfsame processes can equip most of those planets with satellites. The chemistry fits, too. Near the Sun, those incipient planets get very hot, too hot for solid water to form. Further out, around the orbit of Jupiter, for a dust cloud suitable for making our sun and solar system, water can freeze into solid ice. This distinction is important for the chemical composition of the planets, and we can see the main outlines if we focus on just three elements: hydrogen, oxygen, and silicon. Hydrogen and oxygen happen to be the two most abundant elements in the universe, apart from helium, which doesn't undergo chemical reactions. Silicon is less abundant, but still common. When silicon and oxygen combine together, you get silicates, rocks. But even if the oxygen can mop up all the available silicon, some 96% of the oxygen is still unattached, and it combines with hydrogen to make water. There is so much hydrogen, 1,000 times as much as oxygen, that virtually all of the oxygen that doesn't go into rocks gets locked away in water. So by far the most common compound in the condensing disk is water. Close to the star, that water is liquid, even vapor, but out at Jovian distances, it's solid ice. You can pick up a lot of solid mass if you're condensing in a region where ice can form, so the planets there are bigger, and, at least to begin with, they are icy. Nearer the star, the planets are smaller and rocky. But now the big guys can parley their initial weight advantage into an even bigger one. Anything that is 10 times the mass of the Earth or greater can attract and retain the two most abundant elements of the disk, hydrogen and helium. So the big balls soak up large amounts of extra mass in the form of these two gases. They can also retain compounds like methane and ammonia, which are volatile gases closer to the star. This theory explains rather a lot. It gets all the main features of the solar system pretty much right. It allows for the odd exceptional motion, but not too many. It agrees with observations of condensing gas clouds in distant regions of space. It may not be perfect, and some special pleading might be necessary to explain odd things like Pluto, but most of the important features click neatly into place. It also seems likely that huge numbers of planets exist without a central star. In 2000, a team led by Raphael Rebollo observed isolated large planets. A survey of such bodies in the Sigma Orionis cluster shows that the smaller these bodies are, the more numerous they become. If this relationship continues down to Earth-sized bodies, which are too small to observe with current methods, then isolated planets will litter the galaxy. There are probably hundreds of them within 30 light-years of Earth, for example. But without a nearby star, there is no way we can observe them directly. There is no star to wobble, no light output to dim as a planet gets in the way. And the planets themselves emit only reflections of distant starlight, far too faint to be seen from here. The conventional theory of planetary formation in which a star and its accompanying solar system coming to being together cannot apply to such worlds. Small gas clouds are not massive enough to collapse under gravity in the right way, but magnetic effects might cause a collapsing gas cloud round a star to break up and be ejected before its planets are fully formed. Or perhaps these worlds came into being in the usual way, but were then ejected from their solar systems. The future of the solar system is at least as interesting as its past. The picture of the solar system that emerged from the ideas of Newton and his contemporaries was very much that of a clockwork universe, a celestial machine that, once set ticking, would continue to follow some simple mathematical rules and continue ticking merrily away forever. They even built celestial machines called orreries, with lots and lots of cogwheels, in which little brass planets with ivory moons went round and round when you turned a handle. We now know that the cosmic clockwork can go haywire. It won't happen quickly, but there may be some big changes to the solar system on the way. The underlying reason is chaos. Chaos in the sense of chaos theory, with all those fancy multicoloured fractal things, a rapidly expanding area of mathematics which is invading all of the other sciences. Chaos teaches us that simple rules need not lead to simple behaviour, something that Ponder Stibbons and the other wizards are in the process of discovering. In fact, simple rules can lead to behaviour that in certain respects has distinct elements of randomness. Chaotic systems start out behaving predictably, but after you cross some prediction horizon, all predictions fail. Weather is chaotic, with a prediction horizon of about 4 days. The solar system, we now know, is chaotic, with a prediction horizon of tens of millions of years. For example, we can't be sure which side of the sun Pluto will be in 100 million years' time. It will be in the same orbit, but its position in that orbit is completely uncertain. We know this because of some mathematical work that was done, in part, with an orrery. But this was a digital orrery, a custom-built computer that could do celestial mechanics very fast. The digital orrery was developed by Jack Wisdom's research group, which, in competition with its rival, headed by Jacques Lasker, has been extending our knowledge of the solar system's future. Even though a chaotic system is unpredictable in the long run, you can make a whole series of independent attempts at predicting it, and then see what they agree about. According to the mathematics, you can be pretty sure those things are right. One of the most striking results is that the solar system is due to lose a planet. About 1 billion years from now, Mercury will move outwards from the Sun until it crosses the orbit of Venus. At that point, a close encounter between Venus and Mercury will fling one or the other, possibly both, out of the solar system altogether. Unless they hit something on the way, which is highly unlikely, but possible. It might even be the Earth, or the passing Venus might join us in a cosmic dance, whose end result is the Earth being flung out of the solar system. The details are unpredictable, but the general scenario is very likely. This means that we've got the wrong picture of the solar system. On a human timescale, it's a very simple place in which nothing much changes. On its own timescale, hundreds of millions of years, it's full of drama and excitement, with planets roaring all over the place, whirling around each other and dragging each other out of orbit in a mad gravitational dance. This is vaguely reminiscent of Worlds in Collision, a book published in 1950 by Immanuel Velikovsky, who believed that a giant comet was once spat out by Jupiter, passed close to the Earth, twice, had a love affair with Mars, giving rise to a brood of baby comets, and finally retired to live in peace as Venus. Along the way, it gave rise to many strange effects that became stories in the Bible. Velikovsky was right about one thing: the orbits of the planets are not fixed forever. He wasn't right about much else. Do other solar systems encircle distant stars, or are we unique? Until a few years ago, there was a lot of argument about this question, but no hard evidence. Most scientists, if they had to bet, would have backed the existence of other solar systems, because the collapsing dust cloud mechanism could easily get going almost anywhere there's cosmic dust, and there are 100 billion stars in our own galaxy, let alone the billions upon billions of others in the universe, all of which once were cosmic dust. But that's only indirect evidence. Now the position is much clearer. Characteristically, however, the story involves at least one false start, and a critical re-examination of evidence that at first looked rather convincing. In 1967, Jocelyn Bell, a graduate student at the University of Cambridge, was working for a doctorate under the direction of Anthony Hewish. Their field was radio astronomy. Like light, radio is an electromagnetic wave, and like light, radio waves can be emitted by stars. Those radio waves could be detected using parabolic dish receivers, today's satellite TV dishes are a close relative, rather misleadingly called radio telescopes, even though they work on very different principles from normal optical telescopes. If we look at the sky in the radio part of the electromagnetic spectrum, we can often see things that are not apparent using ordinary visible light. This should be no surprise. For example, military snipers can see in the dark using infrared waves, detecting things by the heat they emit. The technology in those days wasn't terribly slick, and the radio signals were recorded on long rolls of paper using automatic pens that drew wiggly curves in good old-fashioned ink. Bell was given the task of looking for interesting things on the paper charts, carefully scanning about 400 feet of chart per week. What she found was very strange, a signal that pulsated about 30 times per second. Hewish was skeptical, suspecting that the signal was somehow generated by their measuring instruments, but Bell was convinced it was genuine. She searched through 3 miles of previous charts and found several earlier instances of the same signal, which proved she was right. Something out there was emitting the radio equivalent of a reverberating whistle. The object responsible was named a pulsar, a pulsating star-like object. What could these strange things be? Some people suggested they were radio signals from an alien civilization, but all attempts to extract the alien equivalent of the Jerry Springer Show failed, which was possibly just as well. There seemed to be no structured messages hidden in the signals. In fact, what they are now believed to be is even stranger than an alien TV program. Pulsars are thought to be neutron stars, stars composed of highly degenerate matter containing only neutrons, usually a mere 12 miles, 20 kilometers, in diameter. Recall that neutron stars are incredibly dense, formed when a larger star undergoes gravitational collapse. That initial star, as we have seen, will be spinning, and because of conservation of angular momentum, the resulting neutron star has to spin a lot faster. In fact, it typically spins through about 30 complete revolutions every second. For a star, that's pretty speedy. Only a tiny star, like a neutron star, can do it. If an ordinary star were to revolve that fast, its surface would have to be travelling faster than light, which wouldn't greatly please Einstein. More realistically, a normal star would be torn apart at much lower speeds. But a neutron star is small, and its angular momentum is comparatively large, and pirouetting 30 times a second is no problem at all. For a helpful analogy, contemplate our own Earth. Like a pulsar, it spins on an axis. Like a pulsar, it has a magnetic field. The magnetic field has an axis too, but it's different from the axis of rotation. That's why magnetic north is not the same as true north. There's no good reason for magnetic north to be the same as true north on a pulsar either. If it isn't, that magnetic axis whips round 30 times every second. A rapidly spinning magnetic field emits radiation, known as synchrotron radiation, and it emits it in 2 narrow beams, which point along the magnetic axis. In short, a neutron star projects twin radio beams, like the spinning gadgetry on top of a terrestrial lighthouse. So if you look at a neutron star in radio light, you see a bright flash as the beam points towards you, and then virtually nothing until the beam comes round again. Every second, you see 30 flashes. That's what Bell had noticed. If you're a living creature of remotely orthodox construction, you definitely do not want your star to be a pulsar. Synchrotron radiation is spread over a wide range of wavelengths, from visible light to X-rays, and X-rays can seriously damage the health of any creature of remotely orthodox construction. But no astronomer ever seriously suspected that pulsars might have planets anyway. If a big star collapses down to an incredibly dense neutron star, surely it will gobble up all the odd bits of matter hanging around nearby, won't it? Perhaps not. In 1991, Matthew Bales announced that he had detected a planet circling the pulsar PSR 1829-10 with the same mass as Uranus, and lying at a distance similar to that of Venus from the Sun. The known pulsars are much too far away for us to see planets directly. Indeed, all stars, even the nearest ones, are too far away for us to see planets directly. However, you can spot a star that has planets by watching it wiggle as it walks. Stars don't sit motionless in space. They generally seem to be heading somewhere, presumably as the result of the gravitational attraction of the rest of the universe, which is lumpy enough to pull different stars in different directions. Most stars move near enough in straight lines. A star with planets, though, is like someone with a dancing partner. As the planets whirl round the star wobbles from side to side. That makes its path across the sky slightly wiggly. Now, if a big fat dancer whirls a tiny feather of a partner around, the fat one hardly moves at all. But if the two partners have equal weight, they both revolve round a common centre. By observing the shape of the wiggles, you can estimate how massive any encircling planets are and how close to the star their orbits are. This technique first earned its keep with the discovery of double stars, where the dancing partner is a second star, and the wobbles are fairly pronounced because stars are far more massive than planets. As instrumentation has become more accurate, ever tinier wobbles can be detected, hence ever tinier dancing partners. Bales announced that pulsar PSR 1829-10 had a dancing partner whose mass was that of a planet. He couldn't observe the wiggles directly, but he could observe the slight changes they produced in the timing of the pulses in the signal. The only puzzling feature was the rotational period of the planet, exactly 6 Earth months. Bit of a coincidence. It quickly turned out that the supposed wiggles were not caused by a planet going round the pulsar, but by a planet much closer to home, Earth. The instruments were doing the wiggling at this end, not the pulsar at the far end. Scarcely had this startling claim of a pulsar planet been withdrawn, however, when Alexander Volstein and Dale Frail announced the discovery of two more planets, both circling pulsar PSR 1257+12, a pulsar solar system with at least two worlds. The way you wiggle when you have two dancing partners is more complex than the way you do it with one, and it's difficult to mistake such a signal for something generated at the receiving end by the motion of the Earth. So this second discovery seems to be fairly solid, unless there is a way for pulsars to vary their output signals in just such a complex manner without having planets. Maybe the radio beam could be a bit wobbly. We can't go there to find out, so we have to do the best we can from here. And from here, it looks good. So there do exist planets outside our solar system, but it's the possibility of life that really makes distant planets interesting, and a pulsar planet with all those X-rays is definitely not a place for anything that wants to be alive for very long. But now, conventional stars are turning out to have planets too. In October 1995, Michel Mayor and Didier Queloz found wobbles in the motion of the star 51 Pegasi that were consistent with a planet of about half Jupiter's mass. Their observations were confirmed by Geoffrey Marcy and Paul Butler, who found evidence for two more planets, one 7 times the mass of Jupiter, orbiting 70 Virginis, and 1 2 or 3 times Jupiter's mass, orbiting 47 Ursae Majoris. By 1996, 7 such planets had been found. As we write, about 70 extra solar planets have been detected, either by the wobble method or by observing the light output from a star and seeing whether it changes as an orbiting planet reflects different amounts of its light. Theoretical calculations show that with improved telescopes, this method might even be able to detect how fast the planet is rotating. Even now, new extrasolar planets are being found virtually every week. The exact number fluctuates because every so often astronomers discover problems with previous measurements that cast doubt on somebody else's favorite new planet. But the general trend is up. And our nearest sun-like neighbor, Epsilon Eridani, is now known to possess an encircling dust cloud, perhaps like our sun's Oort cloud, thanks to observations made in 1998 by James Greaves and colleagues. We can't see any wobbles, though, so if it has planets, their mass must be less than 3 times that of Jupiter. A year earlier, David Trilling and Robert Brown used observations of a similar dust cloud round 55 Cancri, which does wobble, to show that it has a planet whose mass is at most 1.9 Jupiters. This definitely rules out alternative explanations of the unseen companion, for example that it might be a brown dwarf, a failed star. Although today's telescopes cannot detect an alien planet directly, future telescopes might. Conventional astronomical telescopes use a big, slightly dish-shaped mirror to focus incoming light, plus lenses and prisms to pick up the image and send it to what used to be an eyepiece for an astronomer to look down, but then became a photographic plate and is now likely to be a charge-coupled device, a sensitive electronic light detector hooked up to a computer. A single telescope of conventional design would need a very big mirror indeed to spot a planet round another star, a mirror some 100 yards, 100 meters, across. The biggest mirror in existence today is 1/10 that size, and to see any detail on the alien world you'd need an even bigger mirror, so none of this is really practicable. But you don't have to use just one telescope. A technique known as interferometry makes it possible, in principle, to replace a single mirror 100 yards wide by two much smaller mirrors 100 yards apart. Both produce images of the same star or planet, and the incoming light waves that form those images are aligned very accurately and combined. The two-mirror system gathers less light than a complete 100-yard mirror would, but it can resolve the same amount of tiny detail. And with modern electronics, very small quantities of incoming light can be amplified. In any case, what you actually do is use dozens of smaller mirrors, together with a lot of clever trickery that keeps them aligned with each other and combines the images that they receive in an effective manner. Radio astronomers use this technique all the time. The biggest technical problem is keeping the length of the path from the star to its image the same for all of the smaller telescopes, to within an accuracy of one wavelength. The technique is relatively new in optical astronomy because the wavelength of visible light is far shorter than that of radio waves. But for visible light, the real killer is that it's not worth bothering if your telescopes are on the ground. The Earth's atmosphere is in continual turbulent motion, bending incoming light in unpredictable ways. Even a very powerful ground-based telescope will produce a fuzzy image, which is why the Hubble Space Telescope is in orbit round the Earth. Its planned successor, the Next Generation Space Telescope, will be 1 million miles away, orbiting the Sun, delicately poised at a place called Lagrange, point L2. This is a point on the line from the Sun to the Earth, but further out, where the Sun's gravity, the Earth's gravity, and the centrifugal force acting on the orbiting telescope all cancel out. Hubble's structure includes a heavy tube which keeps out unwanted light, especially light reflected from our own planet. It's a lot darker out near L2, and that cumbersome tube can be dispensed with, saving launch fuel. In addition, L2 is a lot colder than low Earth orbit, and that makes infrared telescopy much more effective. Interferometry uses a widely separated array of small telescopes instead of one big one, and for optical astronomy, the array has to be set up in space. This produces an added advantage, because space is big. Or in more discworldly terms, a place to be big in. The biggest distance between telescopes in the array is called the baseline. Out in space, you can create interferometers with gigantic baselines. Radio astronomers have already made one that is bigger than the Earth by using one ground-based telescope antenna and one in orbit. Both NASA and the European Space Agency, ESA, have missions on the drawing board for putting prototype optical interferometer arrays, FLOCs is a more evocative term, into space. Sometime around 2003, NASA will launch Space Technology 3, previously named Deep Space 3, involving two spacecraft flying 0.6 miles, 1 kilometer, apart, and maintaining station relative to each other to a precision of less than half an inch, 1 centimeter. A successor, Starlight, will follow in 2005. Another NASA venture, the Space Interferometry Mission, will employ 3 interferometers with a 10-meter baseline and is tentatively due to launch in 2009. And NASA is thinking about a terrestrial planet finder in 2012, which will look not just for planets, but for carbon dioxide, water vapor, ozone, and methane, which could be signs of life. Or at least of a planet that might be able to support life, similar to ours. Life Finder, with no specific date, would look more closely. The European Space Agency, ESA, has similar missions on the drawing board. SMART 2, consisting of 2 satellites orbiting in formation, is planned for 2006. A more ambitious ESA project is DARWIN, a flotilla of 6 telescopes that could be in space by 2014. The biggest dream of all, though, is NASA's Planet Imager, penciled in for 2020. A squadron of 5 spacecraft, each equipped with 4 optical telescopes, will deploy itself into an interferometer with a baseline of several thousand miles and start mapping alien planets. The nearest star is just over 4 light-years away. Computer simulations show that 50 telescopes with a baseline of just 95 miles, 150 kilometers, can produce images of a planet 10 light-years away that are good enough to spot continents and even moons the size of ours. With 150 telescopes and the same baseline, you could look at the Earth from 10 light-years away and see hurricanes in its atmosphere. Think what could be done with a 1,000-mile baseline. Planets outside our solar system do exist then, and they probably exist in abundance. That's good news if you're hoping that somewhere out there are alien life forms. The evidence for those, though, is controversial. Mars, of course, is the traditional place where we expect to find life in the solar system, partly because of myths about Martian canals, which astronomers thought they'd seen in their telescopes, but which turned out to be illusions when we sent spacecraft out there to take a close look, partly because conditions on Mars are in some ways similar to those on Earth, though generally nastier, and partly because dozens of science fiction books have subliminally prepared us for the existence of Martians. Life does show up in nasty places here, finding a foothold in volcanic vents, in deserts, and deep in the Earth's rocks. Nevertheless, we've found no signs of life on Mars. Yet. For a while, some scientists thought we had. In 1996, NASA announced signs of life on Mars. A meteorite dug up in the Antarctic with the code number ALHA4001 had been knocked off Mars 15 million years ago by a collision with an asteroid and plunged to Earth 13,000 years ago. When it was sliced open and the interior examined at high magnification, we found 3 possible signs of life. There were markings like tiny fossil bacteria, crystals containing iron like those made by certain bacteria, and organic molecules resembling some found in fossil bacteria on Earth. It all pointed to Martian bacteria. Not surprisingly, this claim led to a big argument, and the upshot is that all three discoveries are almost certainly not evidence for life at all. The fossil bacteria are much too small, and most of them are steps on crystal surfaces that have caused funny shapes to form in the metal coatings used in electron microscopy. The iron-bearing crystals can be explained without invoking bacteria at all, and the organic molecules could have got there without the aid of Martian life. However, in 1998, the Mars Global Surveyor did find signs of an ancient ocean on Mars. At some point in the planet's history, huge amounts of water gushed out of the highlands and flowed into the northern lowlands. It was thought that this water just seeped away or evaporated, but now it turns out that the edges of the northern lowlands are all at much the same height, like shorelines eroded by an ocean. The ocean, if it existed, covered a quarter of Mars' surface. If it contained life, there ought to be Martian fossils for us to find, dating from that period. The current favourite for life in the solar system is a surprise, at least to people who don't read science fiction: Jupiter's satellite, Europa. It's a surprise because Europa is exceedingly cold and covered in thick layers of ice. However, that's not where the life is suspected to live. Europa is held in Jupiter's massive gravitational grasp, and tidal forces warm its interior. This could mean that the deeper layers of the ice have melted to form a vast underground ocean. Until recently, this was pure conjecture, but the evidence for liquid water beneath Europa's surface has now become very strong indeed. It includes the surface geology, gravitational measurements, and the discovery that Europa's interior conducts electricity. This finding, made in 1998 by K.K. Kurana and others, came from observations of the worldlet's magnetic field, made by the space probe Galileo. The shape of the magnetic field is unusual, and the only reasonable explanation so far is the existence of an underground ocean, whose dissolved salts make it a weak conductor of electricity. Callisto, another of Jupiter's moons, has a similar magnetic field, and is now also thought to have an underground ocean. In the same year, T.B. McCord and others observed huge patches of hydrated salts, salts whose molecules contain water, on Europa's surface. This might perhaps be a salty crust deposited by upwelling water from a salty ocean. There are tentative plans to send out a probe to Europa, land it, and drill down to see what's there. The technical problems are formidable. The ice layer is at least 10 miles, 16 kilometers thick, and the operation would have to be carried out very carefully, so as not to disturb or destroy the very thing we're hoping to find, Europan organisms. Less invasively, it would be possible to look for telltale molecules of life in Europa's thin atmosphere, and plans are afoot to do this too. Nobody expects to find Europan antelopes, or even fishes, but it would be surprising if Europa's water-based chemistry, apparently an ocean 100 miles, 160 kilometers deep, has not produced life. Almost certainly, there are sub-oceanic volcanoes where very hot sulfurous water is vented through the ocean floor. These provide a marvellous opportunity for complicated chemistry, much like the chemistry that started life on Earth. The least controversial possibility would be an array of simple bacteria-like chemical systems, forming towers around the hot vents, much as earthly bacteria do in the Baltic Sea. More complicated creatures like amoebas and paramecians would be a pleasant surprise. Anything beyond that, such as multicellular organisms, would be a bonus. Don't expect plants. There's not enough light that far from the sun, even if it could filter down through the layers of ice. Europan life would have to be powered by chemical energy, as it is around Earth's underwater volcanic vents. Don't expect Europan life forms to look like the ones round our vents, though. They will have evolved in a different chemical environment. In 2001, Brad Dalton, an astrogeophysicist, geologist for other worlds, wondered whether we might already have seen alien life. Europa's surface is covered with red-brown marks, especially along what appear to be cracks in the ice. Dalton discovered that the infrared spectrum of these marks is very similar to that of earthly bacteria that can survive in very cold environments. In fact, for three species of bacteria, the spectrum is closer than that for the most likely alternative explanation of the marks, mineral salt seeping up through the cracks. Europa's surface is too cold for even these bacteria, but they might thrive in the ocean and somehow be transported to the surface.